Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of What's It Like, where I interview people from all over the place about something unique to them, some experience that they've gone through. As always, my typical disclaimer, this is one person's story. Somebody else may have a very similar experience, but have a very different story to tell. And that is okay. We're just getting a window into what something like this might be like for somebody. So I would like to go ahead and welcome our guest for today. Welcome to the show, Sam.
Thank you for having me, Hannah. It's lovely to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so go ahead and tell our listeners in like a sentence or two, what is the experience that you're sharing with us today?
Okay, so my name is Samantha Milner, or Sam for short, and I run a food blog with my husband Dominic. We are full-time food bloggers and we focus on cooking with kitchen gadgets. I think your instant pot pressure cooker, air fryer, bread maker, slow cooker, etc.
Awesome. So yeah, so tell me how you got into this. What made you first interested in food, food blogging and blogging and all that? And how did you first get involved?
Well, I started off like a lot of online entrepreneurs, where I started off selling your rubbish on eBay, you know, someone else's, your junk, someone else's treasure kind of thing. So I started off there. I sold quite a few interesting things. And then when I ran out of physical things to sell, I started selling ebooks, which back in 2005, they didn't really exist. Mm-hmm. They were just kind of a PDF, I suppose, of the cabbage soup diet. And that used to sell like crazy on eBay. I could not believe how well it sold.
Huh.
And yeah, and I said to my husband, we went on holiday with the money we'd made off the cabbage soup diet. And while on holiday, I said to my husband, we better start a website. You know, we can't just sell off eBay forever. And then we kind of got into owning websites. And then when blogging became a thing, which was kind of 2008, we started blogs together and we actually moved abroad. We were living in England at the time and we moved to Portugal. Because we kind of figured we can work anywhere with an internet connection. Why are we staying in England? So we kind of went to Portugal. And the thing about being in Portugal is there's no money to be made unless you work for yourself. So we always knew that we would carry on with a website or a blog. And we did several years of different types of blogs and managing them for customers. I mean, we had some really interesting niches that we were in. For example, we had a funeral site that just kind of had the funeral poems. So when people are typing into Google what funeral poem they want, it came up. But one site that we had at the time that we really enjoyed was an Amazon site specializing in kitchen gadgets. And it had the kind of the KitchenAid stuff on there, Hamilton Beach. And we really enjoyed that. So when it got to the point where we thought to ourselves, it was sick of managing 20 or 30 blogs, let's just focus on one. We said, we're going to do a food blog and we're going to put every bit of effort, every last hour into this and see if we can make a success of it.
Okay, so you got started on it, and what were your first steps there? Like when you were like, "This is what we want to do," what were your immediate first steps, and then what did you kind of build up to?
Well, to start with, obviously, you need your domain name, so you know, recipethis.com. We actually found that we wanted one that already had authority or that already had a history, so that we would rank in Google. So we actually went to the GoDaddy auctions and we just put recipe in and it showed ones that were available for sale. And Recipe This kind of came out and thought that sounds really catchy. Yeah. Because, you know, in the future, because we'd already done podcasting before that, in the future, when you want something short, when you're on a podcast or in a video, a two-worder is so much easier to say than these really long names that some people have. So we kind of started there. And we said, our main kitchen gadget is always going to be the air fryer. So when we started it, we did 90 days straight of just air fryer recipes so that we could build up authority in Google and start building up the traffic on social media as well. And we started it. It was the 1st of November 2015. So it's just turned 5 years old now.
Wow. Okay. So you got this set up, and how did you, you had already been doing some podcasting and some connecting that way. How did you get readers to connect with you? Were they mostly original people who had been following you anyway? How did you continue to expand your base?
We were almost starting from scratch. Prior to that, we had a UK diet blog, and it focused on a particular diet that's popular in the UK. So what we did is some of the content that we already had on that, we reproduced for our new site. So what was doing well on that, we kind of brought the traffic over from that. But apart from that, everything else was brand new. We focused our attention on writing really good quality content that Google would pick up, so that we could focus our attention on traffic coming from Google, from the search engines. And we also focused a lot on Pinterest, because Pinterest was at its best then. It was a lot easier to get traffic from Pinterest in late 2015 compared to what it's like now. Now it's like, you know, it's had a lot of algorithm updates, and it's much harder to get conversions on Pinterest, whereas back then you could pin whatever you liked, and you know, you'd have 10,000 people visiting your site.
Yeah. So where does most of your traffic come from now?
Right now, I would say we're on about 61% is Google. Okay. And you know, you just have to remember for a second, my brain's foggy. Yeah, so 61% is Google. And about just over 20% is Pinterest.
Okay.
Which those are our two main traffic sources. So if we go back to, let's say, 2017, it was probably 35% Google to probably about 35% Pinterest. So it was more an equal split back then. But now, since Pinterest has changed a lot, mm-hmm. a lot of the traffic comes from Google. But I'd rather have Google traffic over Pinterest, because when people are putting something into Google, it's something that they're seeking right now. You know, it's on their mind. They're more likely to read through your blog. They're more likely to join your mailing list. They're more likely to buy products that you recommend, because it's on their brain right now. If they've put into Google, for example, soup maker recipes, and they then see your list of lots of soup maker recipes, they're likely to bookmark a load of them, join your mailing list, and buy your soup maker cookbook. Whereas if someone sees you on Pinterest, they might not even have a soup maker, and it might just come up in somebody else's feed of someone else to follow in. They might pin it because it looks interesting, but we all have a lot of things on Pinterest. I know I do. I've pinned them like 2 years ago, and I haven't looked at them since, and I've never actually visited the website. So Pinterest traffic's good, but it's not in Google's league, is how I would explain it better. And then after Google and Pinterest, we get traffic from let me just think who my top traffic sources are after that. Facebook, of course. I get some from Twitter. I get good traffic from my mailing list. Mailing list is fantastic, because the people that are coming to your site, they're returning, they're joining your mailing list, they believe in you, they kind of treat you like you're the girl next door, and they want to be friends with you, you want to be friends with them, and they trust your opinion.
Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense. So as a blogger, as something that is a source of income, what primarily makes up that income? Is this people buying your products from the site, or your cookbooks from the site? Is it a marketing advertisement deal? How does a blogger make money off of this?
I love that question, Hannah, because let me say first, before I answer the question, you know, the hardest thing when you're a blogger is when you go out for dinner with people you don't know, and the first thing they say is, oh, you're a blogger. How do you make money from that? And the, you know, or why are you a blogger? They treat you like you're some sort of weirdo. You know, you kind of get treated like you're the tramp that lives on the street. And we always have that feeling, you know, where they're thinking, they're looking down their noses at us. They don't respect what we do, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then I remember a few years ago, some of my parents' friends were very much like that. And when they found out we were just about to go to Disney World for 5 weeks, they soon changed their opinion of us. Uh-huh. And they never did ask us how to monetize. So let me tell you about the monetization.
Yeah.
Our number one monetization is advertising networks. So that's when you visit a blog. It doesn't have to be food. It can be any industry. And they're serving advertisements on the site. There's AdSense, which is run by Google, which pays absolute peanuts. And you'd have to be getting a billion page views a month for it to actually make you any money. Mm-hmm. And the more popular one is Mediavine. Which is has a requirement that you have to have, I think it's about 1,000 page views a day equivalent to be able to join their network. We've recently left them, but it's the best place for beginner bloggers to kind of think, that's my end goal, is to get onto Mediavine. Mm. And then after Mediavine, the next level up is AdThrive, which we recently moved to. But you just have to have, I think it's about 100,000 page views a month to get on AdThrive. But they're very particular of which bloggers they take. You don't have any rubbish. You don't have any spammy sites on there. And it feels like more business people. You know, it doesn't feel cheap, in other words.
Yeah.
And then after that, we're monetized through the sale of ebooks. Courses, affiliate links, but we don't really do a lot on affiliate links because we find it doesn't really suit our audience. We do, whereas most people do a lot on affiliates, we kind of do more on the ebooks and the courses side of things instead. But the end goal is right now is that the courses will make more money than the advertising networks. I think that's the ultimate goal for a lot of bloggers, because the advertising networks, it's very much based on your traffic.
Yeah.
You're only earning a small amount for each bit of traffic compared to how much you're making on a course. If you think courses online, they often sell for about $500. With a very good advertising network, you'll be lucky if you get $20 for each 1,000 visitors. So, you know, it's kind of in a different league of courses. So I think that's the ultimate goal for a lot of bloggers. There's many that are very high traffic sites that make all the money off advertising, don't have a single affiliate link on their site, and it's literally just ad networks and nothing else. Because if you're getting 4 million page views a month and you're getting $20 for each 1,000 of those, you know, you're on a considerable income, you know. But a lot of bloggers, it's kind of like, I compare it to acting in a way, you know, that you have your high end is your movie stars like your Tom Hanks. You know, your low end is Joey's character in Friends when he's trying to get an acting job, but he's actually working in a cafe or whatever while he's trying to. It's very much like that. There's a lot in the blogging industry that has still got full-time jobs, hoping and dreaming that they're going to make it, but most don't. I'd say the average is that people make $1,000 a month from blogging, you know.
Yeah.
But there'll be those that will excel. So, you know, it's about going for it. It's about consistency, is what my husband always says, because you notice those that haven't made it are the ones that kind of come in and out of having the blog. They'll blog 1 week and then they haven't blogged for 6 months. Those that don't take it very seriously, in other words.
Yeah. So how frequently do you post something?
Oh, I thought we'd come to that question.
Oh, no.
Well, yeah, it's one of those. I mean, it's one of those questions that in the blogging industry, You kind of get told off if you do too many, mm-hmm. as in that means that your content can't be quality. And then if you don't do enough, you're told you're not consistent enough. Mm-hmm. I'd say the average food blog does about 3. I do between 5 and 14 a week.
A week, okay.
Yeah, I like writing. I've always got something to say. Some people find writing easier than others. I'm one of those that finds it easier. I talk a lot, so blogging suits me, but other people have a lot of writer's block and they do struggle. Or there's some, take for example, if you're a baking blogger, so you know, you're the one making all the cakes and the cookies, it's very, very difficult and time consuming to take pictures and to do a new baking recipe. So a baking blog you would expect 2 a week out of, but we're in the air fryer and instant pot niche where it's easy to cook a new recipe, you know. When you're just teaching people how to bread a bit of chicken or how to reheat some frozen chicken, it's not a big deal, it's not as time consuming. So I kind of go with however many I feel is a good fit for the time. I prefer to be around the 4 to 5 a week mark. But sometimes when it's certain seasons, I will go higher. For example, back in January, January is our highest traffic month of the year. Hmm. I did 2 a day for the whole of January. So, you know, 14 a week. My husband looked like he'd want to kill me when I suggested it, but we did it. Yeah. And it gave us, I think, about 30% traffic growth just from doing extra in the January. So it does make a huge difference to your traffic, the more you can do. But it's also about keeping the quality up without, you know, you want to keep your consistency, but you want the quality. So I kind of have a content calendar where I aim for 5, and then if it's slightly more, if it's slightly less, then I'm happy. I think the lowest I've ever done is 3 a week, and that was when we went traveling a couple of summers ago, and we were on the road without internet for quite some time. So I did some recipes while we were camping, but I didn't spend a lot of time on the blog at that time.
Yeah. So you've been doing this for a while. What have you learned is really important to, what do you need to be able to do or to be good at this? Like what sets, there are a lot of food bloggers. What sets a good food blogger, or what you're trying to be, or maybe already are, maybe you've reached your goals for that. But what you see as a good food blogger, how is that set apart from somebody who's just like an average food blogger?
I think one of the main things is a blogger is essentially a writer. So I think you have to, I'm not saying you have to have a degree in English, because you certainly don't, but you have to be comfortable being able to write a lot on a subject. You know, there's no point choosing a subject because you think it's popular. If you can't say, I can write 1,000 posts on this subject, you know, if you think, I've got a dog, I should have a pet site, you can earn some money off that. You know, could you write 1,000 posts on it? That's the starting question when it comes to blogging. For example, we have created about 1,100 posts in 5 years. So, you know, that is a lot of content, especially when each post is like 1,000 words or thereabouts. And, you know, my husband says this a lot, but to be a business person is important, because you see, those that are the most successful at it are the ones that have had a history in business, have worked for people in business, have had their own business, have worked in corporate. It makes a big difference, you know, whereas the housewife that's never worked for themselves, it's the one that struggles, because there's a lot to learn. And if, say, you've worked in corporate, in marketing, for example, you've picked up a lot of tricks along the way. Or like, there's quite a few food blogs that either the husband or the wife is a qualified chef. So then it makes it easier for you to come up with content and to understand what you're doing, really. And I think another thing is the discipline, because you're working from home, you can't spend all day chatting to your friends on Facebook. Mm-hmm. I won't have my Facebook open or my emails open when I'm working. I'll get in the office, I'll do my stuff, I'll make sure I get as much done as possible in the time period I've got. And that helps me grow, because when you're getting a lot done in each and every month, you know, it shows, and, you know, it really does help your business improve and grow. Because even if you are a blogger, you're still running a business. You know, you've still got to think about everything that somebody that's got a bricks and mortar business has. You know, you've still got to consider managing a team, for example. You've still got to think about making sure the bills are paid. You've got to keep your customers happy. When customers are emailing you, you want to answer them in a reasonable time frame. So there's a lot of things that are associated that are similar to actually owning a business in the real world rather than the virtual world, you know. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of things that go into it. And I think the other thing where a lot of people fail at is they see someone that's successful in blogging, they want to be them, and then they think to themselves, I'm not growing that fast. Why don't I know about how to do this? I don't know how to do that. And then they forget that that person has been running businesses online for 5 years or 10 years or whatever. And yeah, that it's kind of what puts them off and what makes them quit.
Yeah. And this is my next question might have already been answered. My next question is, I was asking about sort of the downsides, the most difficult or the most tedious or the most frustrating part of this. And it sounds like for you, you're saying a lot of newer bloggers, it's struggling through early days, if not having a lot of growth. What is the most difficult part of this for you now?
I think for me now, you'll laugh when I tell you this. I don't struggle like everybody else struggles. I feel like my disability is the fact that I live in Portugal. I'm a food blogger, and a lot of the ingredients and my readership are American. Mm. So my biggest struggle is being able to get the ingredients. For example, yeah, I went to 4 supermarkets last week just to be able to source celery. I mean, it's celery. Wow. It sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? And, you know, that is one of our biggest things. And then the stupid Portuguese tax system they have here is ridiculous. And I won't bore you with the ins and outs of that, but it's made us realize that we just cannot have growth here, and we're always at a disadvantage to our American bloggers or our UK bloggers. So we're actually moving back to England next year so that we can actually grow our blog more. So, but that kind of thing wouldn't apply to everybody else. The kind of thing that I think people struggle with the most is the learning curve. You know, it's the SEO, it's the social media, it's the writing content. There's just so many different things to learn. And even myself, I'm always reading ebooks and courses, you know, because there's always something else that you want to learn. You know, so what I recommend to beginners is there's ultimatebundles.com, and they do a blogger genius toolkit once a year. And in that, you get courses on lots of different topics. And I recommend that newbies to blogging read that, because it just kind of gives them that that starting curve. It's like the Bible of everything that they could possibly need to know. But just do one thing at a time. Focus on content is king. Just write amazing content. And then let's say each quarter you work on something new until you learn things. Like you could say, right, I've got 3 months to learn Pinterest. I've got 3 months to get my first video on YouTube and get into YouTube, so that you're doing a gradual growth of learning, so that, you know, in 2 years, imagine where you'd be compared to where you are now.
Yeah. You talked a little bit about, you know, some of the resources you continue to look for. Who are some food bloggers or writers, or maybe even just writers in general, not even food writers, who you look to for inspiration or for ideas, kind of your aspirational writers that you're looking to?
I don't really follow that many food bloggers. I think my inspiration for a food blogger would be sallysbakingaddiction.com. She's like, I don't know how she does it all. You know, when some of them are like, wow, how do you achieve everything you've achieved? I don't know a baking food blogger that gets more traffic or that's more successful than what she is. She's got two small children at the moment, and she's brought out, I think, three baking cookbooks. And it's how time consuming it is for baking recipes. You know, like I was saying earlier, it takes a long time to photo every element of a baking recipe and to create it and make sure your measurements are right, because baking is an act of science. And as well as that, she gets incredibly high traffic. So she has a fantastic support team there, so that good customer service is always there. It's a good brand, and she's built it very, very well. And I would say she was my biggest inspiration. I remember following her before I became a food blogger. And what I also love about her, there's a bit of British in me here, is that I hate it when you land on a blog and they only have metric or they only have imperial. Because we're a big world out there. We're not just America. We're not just the UK. And, you know, I have readers that are in Australia, UK, South Africa, America, New Zealand, Canada. You know, they're all from different walks of life. And Sally's the only US baking site that I know of that has both metric and imperial.
Nice.
Oh, yeah.
That's an interesting little piece I hadn't even thought about.
Yeah. You know, because I think when you live in America, you don't really think about it. And I never really thought about it early on. And I remember getting a lot of abuse on one of my recipes from an American guy asking me if I was mixing pharmaceuticals because I was dealing in milliliters.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, and I never thought about it myself until that point. And I remember a load of Canadians jumped on and said, oh, we're all right, we're on metric.
Yeah, yeah. And everybody is, except for the US.
Yeah, and I never realized at that point that I always assumed that Canada was on imperial with America. I didn't actually realize. So it made me want to improve my site at that point. And from that point forward, we've always had metric and imperial on our recipes.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm curious about this. So blogs were nowhere, and then we're suddenly everywhere, and everybody had a blog. And it seems like now maybe blogs are not the place where people go for things anymore. So I'm curious, as to, you've been doing this for a while, have you seen like a rise and fall in how many people either are visiting, or have people like asked you to start a podcast instead? Like, that seems where like that's going next. And I was like, so I don't know. I'm curious if you've seen changes in how blogs as a medium have grown or dropped or shifted over the years.
Well, I think market saturation comes to mind when I think about blogging these days. You see, blogs that started, the richest blogs, the ones that make the most money, are the ones that started 2009 to 2010. They're the ones that are making the most money, because they've got the most content. They were around first. Everybody's recommending them because they know them. And you will always see them first, generally, in the search results. So that makes it harder for the blogs that are 1 year old, 6 years old, because it's harder to compete in the search engines. I think that's a big problem. For example, we are in the Instant Pot niche. And when the Instant Pot first took off was kind of 2016 to 2017. And it was much easier to get traffic for the Instant Pot then compared to how it is now. But there's always something new evolving. There's always something new that people want to know about. I think I read recently that according to Google Trends, there's 1,000 new keywords a day among all niches, not just food. 1,000 a day, new keywords that people are searching for that nobody has written about at that point. So there's lots of chance for growth, but I think it was easier then because you could get a lot more traffic from Pinterest and Instagram and Facebook. And they've kind of said to us bloggers, look, you're not having all our traffic. You know, we're going to make you work a lot harder for it. So back then it was a lot easier to get traffic. I know people that have 5 million likes on Facebook. Back in the day, 80% of their traffic came from Facebook and they would be getting 2 million page views a month. Yet now in 2020, those same likes are equating to 10,000 page views a month. And they've lost all the traffic and then they're having to focus on another source of traffic because it's not working. I think that's the biggest problem in blogging, is that people were too reliant on social media. They didn't build up the mailing list, which is their own. They didn't branch out. They were kind of, oh, I do really well with Facebook. There's no point bothering really with much else. So there's a lot of bloggers right now that focus on updating old blog posts, because the idea there is that when they wrote those blog posts, they weren't thinking about Google. So now they're rewriting everything with Google in mind. So it's kind of changed the shift. And there's a lot more blogs out there now than what there was 5 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, it's just figuring out how they're going to grow them with traffic. And I noticed that the ones that are doing the best are those that are building the mailing list, because then they've got a backup.
Yeah. Oh, I think that makes a lot of sense. I'm curious a little bit as well about, have you, you know, in all the posts that you've done over the last several years, and you've got a ton, have there been any that really did go viral, or were unsurprisingly overwhelmingly popular among all the rest, or has it been pretty consistent?
Oh, I've had some super viral ones. But then again, what does viral actually mean? Yeah. Because, you know, when you're a new blogger and your blog's a year old and you get 1,000 page views in one day from Facebook, you're like, oh, wow, I've gone viral. You know, so I think it means something different to different people and how old your blog is. I mean, I suppose it's about if your traffic's at a normal level, if you suddenly get a massive spike in one day, I think you kind of think of it as viral.
Yeah.
I think my most viral post, it was 101 instant pot recipes for complete beginners. Mm. And it was kind of the ultimate list for those that had just got an instant pot. I reached out to other bloggers to get permission to feature them. And it was very much part of my strategy to make sure I went with big, small and supersized bloggers, with the hope that some of the bigger ones would share it to give it a bump in the right direction. I did it all. It looked fantastic. And I reached out to the bloggers that I'd featured in it. And I think I'd featured about 40 bloggers altogether. And one blogger in particular loved it and shared it on her Facebook, her Pinterest, her everything. And I think in one day from Facebook, she brought me about 40,000 page views.
Wow.
In one day. And I'm like, Jesus Christ the Lord, yeah. How did that happen? And that was like the beginning of March, and it had been published in the February of the 2017. And then I think about a month later, the husband says, we're getting a lot of traffic from it, from Pinterest, you know. So I went and digged into the analytics on Pinterest and in my Google Analytics. And it had, I think it throughout 2017, it ended the year on, I think it was 350,000 shares on Pinterest.
Wow.
Yeah, I looked at that and thought, oh my God, yeah. You know, yeah, it was one of those moments. It's still in our top 10 of our top traffic posts to this day, considering that it's 3.5 years old now. And what I also tried as a strategy is I thought to myself, well, it's particular for Instant Pot beginners. So I put it out on Facebook to the Instant Pot groups on the day that they would all be getting them for Christmas. Or I think it might have been the day after. So I put it out on there thinking to myself, they're my target audience. They've all just joined this Instant Pot group in the same day. I'll put it on there and see what happens. So me and my husband were on the way to do some shopping the day after Christmas, and I did it on my phone when we were en route. I went in the shop. He was waiting in the car with the kids, and I came back out, and he said to me, we've got 50,000 people on that post right now.
Wow.
Because it was on my Facebook account, so he couldn't actually see it. So I went on there, and it was on 1 million views on Facebook, just on one Instant Pot group. How did that happen? Because it was just an idea. You know, when you kind of think, this is going to be a good idea. Yeah. But I was expecting like 20,000 people on it, not that kind of numbers. And I think in the end, between the 26th of December and the 1st of January, it had had 10 million views on Facebook.
Wow. That will do it.
That will do it. And it went, it got, because it was before one of the Facebook algorithm updates. So people were all tagging the friends that had just bought an Instant Pot.
Yeah.
And then they were sharing it to their Facebook page, Facebook walls and the news feeds and that. And it just kind of, went crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think then after that, we got an awful amount of comments that same day that that went out of people saying, I love your list and everything, but I would prefer it in a PDF or an ebook so that I can download all those recipes together. You know, which I can understand that, because if I was new to it and I was looking at this enormous list of 101 recipes that is all linking out to different places, that's what I'd want too. But at the time, especially from a legal point of view, I only had about 60 Instant Pot recipes on my own site.
Right.
And there was no way the people were going to give me permission to put their recipes in an ebook and sell it and make profit from it. So we worked hard on focusing on Instant Pot recipes. And as soon as we had 101 Instant Pot recipes, we took out other people's from that post, replaced them with our own, and we released 101 Instant Pot as a kind of an e-cookbook that people could download. And we also created an affiliate program so other people could promote it too. And it's our bestseller. That's even awesome. Now.
Yeah.
We've updated it since. It's been updated since then. We updated it again this year. But yes, it's our most popular by quite a lot.
Yeah. Okay. So as this podcast goes out, it's going to likely have two audiences, some who may have some experience with this or will in the future, maybe somebody who's wanting to start a food blog or has a small one and they're trying to figure out how to continue to grow it. And then on the other hand, we have people who are never going to do this, who don't have the interest in it, don't know really anything about it. And so I'd love to get just something you might want to say to each group, maybe some encouragement or advice. And you've done some of this already, but maybe like what would you definitely want to say to somebody who is wanting to do this and from your experience versus maybe what would you want somebody who has no experience with this at all to know, maybe correcting a misconception or something that would be valuable for them to understand about being a food blogger, even if that's never anything they're going to do for themselves. So say something to each of these two possible audience members.
So first of all, the biggest misconception, which you'll publish this, and if a food blogger is listening to it, they'll send me hate mail because I'm going against everything here, and that is to say I don't enjoy photography. I'm actually partially sighted and take photos of an iPhone 11 Pro Max. I don't have one of those expensive Canon digital camera thingies. I tried it once and I'm as blind as a bat, and every single picture came out blurred. I was absolutely useless at it. I hired someone for a while to do photos on my behalf. I'd give them the recipe and he would do it for me. And he lived in Canada and he took the most amazing pictures you'd ever seen. But the thing is, they weren't real life. They weren't the girl next door. And I found that I get the best results from my recipes where they look like the kind of recipe photos that the person that's reading it would take themselves rather yeah. than them being magazine looking professional pictures. Because we've all seen these food blogs, haven't we, with these amazing food photography. And I believe it is fantastic for gourmet food bloggers. If you're doing the kind of stuff that would be served at dinner parties, I think that's fine. Go with it. You know, if you're really good at photography, why not? But for a lot of audiences, they want to appreciate how the food is going to look on their plate compared to when they see something and it looks amazing and then they make it and it's like, it's not comparing. Like, for example, a lot of people use camera tricks to make something look better than what it does. I've heard of people blow drying hamburgers to make them look more puffy and alive and all sorts of other things. And I've always found that, especially with me doing the Instant Pot and the air fryer niche, that people want to see the food actually cooked in the gadget. They want to see how it's being used and how they can recreate it at home. So I think as food blogging, I've seen so many people saying, I'd love to be a food blogger, but I'm no good at photography, so I'll never make any money.
Yeah.
I can tell you now, I make six figures food blogging and I take terrible pictures.
Yeah.
They're not the worst in the industry. I know of food bloggers that take worse than me. There's one lady that's in her 60s that lives in America and her pictures are never in focus. And she makes me look good, you know. And yeah. then there's another one that's similar. And we've all, between me and these other two that take rubbish pictures, we've both been at it 5 years or longer. So, you know, we should have improved our game in that time.
Yeah. But
it's not just about the photography. People want a great recipe that they can follow at home. You know, they want somebody that can give them great advice, you know, that can answer all their questions, to be that friend that when they want to know why something burnt that they made or is undercooked, that you quickly answer them and tell them what they did wrong and help them improve their skill. You know, that's what they want. You know, I think it's become this obsession with photography because of the likes of Pinterest.
Yeah.
But as long as it's a decent picture and it's in focus, you know, it doesn't have to have all the bells and whistles on it. And I think that's the problem. Or start off without the bells and whistles and maybe you'll improve to them, but don't feel that food photography is all it's about as a food blogger. I'm not the only one out there that uses their phone instead of a proper camera. I mean, most people are freaked out by the cameras. And the phones these days, especially the iPhone, takes amazing pictures.
Yeah. No, I love that.
Yeah, I've just put out a recipe for frozen corn on the cob. And, you know, it's like I can take a picture of that and it looks absolutely amazing because it's the beautiful yellow that shows up on the screen. But when I'm trying to make a curry look good, it still looks like mush on a plate whenever I make it.
Yeah. Okay. And then, yeah, what would you want somebody to understand who is never going to connect with this at all?
I think the one thing that a lot of my fellow food bloggers would also be saying is stop picking on food blogs when they have ads showing on the site. I think is probably what I'd be getting told to say right now. You know, to understand what a food blog is about, understand the fact that if you're not going to be a food blog but you visit them, that next time you complain at them, just think that you've just read a recipe for free, and the amount of hours that goes into running a food blog is crazy. Mm-hmm. I mean, I easily, when I'm turning it down and I'm not doing much, I still do a 60-hour week. and that's with children to look after as well, you know, a house to take care of. So, you know, just to be nice to bloggers, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's fair.
Yeah, because I think the worst place is Facebook. You know, I see a lot of the hate messages that people get on there that are just, sometimes they're just a bit sarcastic, but sometimes they are really, really quite nasty on some of them on there. So I think it's the appreciation of the hard work that goes into blogs.
Yeah.
You know, and that just next time you follow a blog and they write something good, make sure you share it, because that's like giving a blogger a $10 tip at a restaurant.
Yeah, no, I think that makes a lot of sense. All right, as we close out here, Sam, go ahead and let's obviously share your blog, as well as any other social media or other projects that you would want our listeners to be able to find you at.
Okay, so my website, well, I've mentioned it a few times, sorry, I might have overplugged it, is recipethis.com, and we focus on kitchen gadgets, like I mentioned at the beginning. Yeah. So we have predominantly air fry and instant pot recipes, but we also have some gems for the soup maker, bread maker, slow cooker, sous vide and such like. We also have some free mini courses that you can follow to learn how to use the Instant Pot and the air fryer. And we also have courses teaching you to use them as well. Just feel free to go to recipethis.com, have a navigate around, see what you think. And for social media, we are also on Twitter. We have a Facebook group as well. We have a Facebook page, and we're also on Pinterest. We are not on Instagram because I just feel like it doesn't suit our audience. But you can find all our social media links directly on our website at recipethis.com.
Awesome. Yeah, and I'll make sure and I'll put all that in the show description, the episode description as well, so folks can make sure and find you.
Thank you very much, Hannah.
All those recipes. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Sam, and for sharing your expertise and your knowledge with us.
You're very welcome, Hannah. Thank you so much for having me on your show. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, folks, you can come back and listen next week, where I'll be interviewing somebody else about something entirely different. And if you would like to be a guest on a future podcast, you can send me an email at whatsitlikethepodcast.com, or you can follow me on Twitter. My handle is @whatsitlike. You'll fill out a form and tell me what you might want to talk about. I think everybody's got a story and an experience to share, and I hope to hear yours sometime. Either way, you can come back next week and I'll talk to somebody else then. We'll see you then.